international bond finance. We can understand the nature, content, structure, and operation of the international bond market through a series of core tables. What we're going to do is summarize all of the parties. We'll summarize the key documents. We'll summarize the key uses and applications of all of this. We'll summarize all of the key legal issues, and then we'll also build in timelines and any other ancillary points that are necessary. A lot of the core points and key issues referred to here are all taken from my chapter on bond finance. This is simply creating an alternative visual representation of all of the key points that we're going to be covering. What are we looking at? What we're doing is this. We're contrasting the loan market, specifically the euro loan or euro dollar markets, with the euro bond market within the euro dollar system. In a simple loan transaction, we have a borrower or a borrower's group. We have the syndicate members. They're going to draw the funds down from the interbank markets. And then we have an agent bank who's going to service the loan once it's up and running. All of this will be put together by the arranging bank or the lead bank. In the capital market transaction, what happens? It just becomes a little bit more complicated. We're going to have the issuing company, so it's the same parent company, and it has to decide, do I borrow 100 million through a syndicated loan agreement, syndicated loan document, with mandate letter information memorandum in the loan agreement, or do I go capital markets? If it goes capital markets, it's going to be issuing the debt in an embedded form where we embed the repayment obligation in the bond. The bond of itself is then a transferable and negotiable instrument. And because of that additional transferability and negotiability that that creates, we have additional liquidity, which means that very often we can borrow more cheaper in the capital markets than we can in the loan markets. What does a typical bond transaction look like? We have the issuer. At the bottom, we'll have the investors, either public or private investors. We're then also going to have a managing group and then an underwriting group. And if it's a large issue, we're going to have a selling group as well. The selling group are going to sell the bonds on and ensure that there's full uptake of the whole issue created. The underwriters undertake to purchase anything which the selling group can't sell. What the issuer needs to know is that it's going to receive its 100 million. It doesn't want to take any risk that there will be a shortfall in the uptake. It needs to know that all of this is going to be sold on into the markets. Now, legally, what happens is that the lead bank is going to enter into what we call the subscription agreement on the top right. And under the terms of the subscription agreement, the lead bank undertakes to subscribe for the full issue. So legally, the lead bank will undertake, with the managing group, will undertake to take up the issue. What they want then to ensure is that they can sell all of this on, either through the selling group immediately, and then if that's not taken up, through the underwriting group. This, if it's a large, big, complex issue. So we have the issuer, we have the underwriters, we have the syndicate, the selling group, and the investors. In large structures like this, we will have a trustee appointed to represent the bond holders. We also then separately have an agent bank. Now, it will be a paying agent if there is no trustee. So that's a paying agency agreement. So then the agent is going to act, in this case for the issuer, to ensure that all the payments are made, in particular the coupon, which is the interest payment on the bonds, so the investors receive their interest payments. If there is no trustee, this becomes a fiscal agency agreement. So we're either going to have a paying agent or a fiscal agent. If there's a trustee, we don't need a fiscal agent, so we have a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we'll need a fiscal agency agreement, because any funds held by the agent have to be held on trust under a fiduciary relationship on behalf of the investors. We need to create a trust relationship. If it's a big issue and we have a formal trustee appointed under a separate trust deed, we only have a paying agent. If we don't have a trust deed and there's no fiduciary relationship, then we have a paying agent, we have a fiscal agent under the fiscal agency agreement. Because we have all these additional parties, we have all the additional documentation, and we will come back and look at all of this in further detail. In terms of the core documentation, what are we going to need in this case? Well, again, we'll have a mandate letter. We'll then have, instead of the term sheet in the loan deal, we'll have what we call an invitation telex. All the provisions that outline the core transaction, including specifically the financials initially, as well as the outline obligations and defaults, they go in the term sheet in the loan deal, they'll go in the information telex in the capital market deal. So that's then sent out. The information memorandum will be replicated by what we call the, it's either a prospectus or an offering circular or a listing particulars. They're basically all the same thing. It's a prospectus because there's going to be a public offer. We also call that an offering circular. And then if it's going to be listed on a stock market or an exchange, we call it a listing particular. In practice, it's almost all the same thing. All we'll do is we'll ensure that each document complies with all of the different provisions so we can use it for the same three sets of purposes. So offering circular more generally, it becomes the prospectus if it's a public offer. And then if we're also listing on a stock market, it becomes the listing particulars. We have admission to listing and we have admission to trading. Admission to listing is where you get consent from the local listing authority in a particular country to make a public offer. That used to be the London Stock Exchange in London. But what happened was the London Stock Exchange demutualized. It went from being a private members company to being a public company, which was listed on itself. It listed itself on its own market. Because of that, it was considered that it could no longer discharge its duty as a public authority to manage the listing. So responsibility for listing was transferred from the London Stock Exchange to the Financial Services Authority and now the Financial Conduct Authority. So there's a large section in the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, handbook on listing, and that principally consists of the listing rules as well as the public offer rules and the disclosure rules. We also have admission to trading. When you want to list the bonds on a particular stock market, you then have to apply to that stock market as well. So if you make a public offer, you have admission to listing. If you want to trade on a particular exchange, you also have admission to trading. We can see this further on this table. This is a typical timeline of a common Eurobond or international bond transaction. It's basically a 4-week timetable. We've got the initial marketing approach, decision to decide we're going to issue this, the approaches and the mandates and the initial fee quotes. We have the pre-launch, it's DD-7. We have the formal launch, is the announcement to the public that these are coming. We have the signing, D-Day for plus 14, and then we have D-Day plus 21 is the final closing. This all typically takes place over a 4-week period, and all the different separate stages of this I've summarised on this table. There's 3, if not 4, principal options. We can have a private placement, we can have a preliminary prospectus offering, or we can have an impact day offering. A private placement is whereby the managers subscribe for the full amount and they undertake to purchase everything and ensure it's on sold into the markets. It's also called a bought deal. It's a private bought deal. If we're not making a public offer, this is much easier. We then don't have all the additional regulatory obligations that arise if we're going for a full listing. So this is much cheaper, much quicker, much more effective. And a lot of the biggest companies in the world and governments will simply use a bought deal. So you'll contact Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, you say, I want to raise 60 million or 80 million or 100 million. We're going to do it under a 5-year note program. The notes themselves will have very short, so they'll be, let's say, 30-day notes, 60-day notes. But we want the facility to last 5 years. We're going to then set up what we call a NIF, a note issuance facility. And we'll come back and we'll go over all of this in further detail. How can we do that? Because we're doing it all through one company, we don't have to go for public offers, public listings, it's a bought deal. The lead bank's going to subscribe for everything, undertake to deal with everything, manage everything. If it's a bigger, more public offering, we'll then either have a preliminary prospectus offering or an impact day offering. If it's a preliminary prospectus offering, we have a red herring or a pathfinder. That's when we use the prospectus to generate, measure public interest. What do we think the market's going to do? How is this going to be received? Why? Because we need to price. We need to price the initial core price for the bond itself and the coupon. And we're going to adjust these. Now, the bond itself, we're either going to sell at par, at premium, or discount. Par means face value. Let's say it's $10,000. If it's a $10,000 bond or a note, that, and we sell it at par, we sell it at $10,000. If we think there's going to be a big uptake and a big increase in the price, and the market's going to, this will be well received, we'll add a premium. We might sell this for 103%, maybe 105%. We'll add a premium on top of that. But what we can also do is we can have a discount. We can discount the price. If we want to promote more interest, we can reduce it. So 98%, 96%, you see? And very often what will simply happen is this. As you adjust the price from par, premium, or discount, it'll adjust the coupon. So if the price goes down, you have a discount, and the discount becomes larger, the coupon can become smaller. But if you don't want to pay a high coupon, you can issue it par or issue it premium, then the coupon may have to go up. You can also have what we call deep discount bonds or deep discount notes. In that case, you have a very substantial decrease in the price. So you might offer them for maybe 80%. Or even 70%. Now, why would you do that? Because of the tax advantage. Because what you're effectively then doing is this. You're rolling up the interest into the price of the bond and you're deducting it from the face value. So you basically embed the interest for the next 5 years or 10 years or 20 years in the price of the bond. And you take it off the bond up front. So what happens is the investor is buying the bond with all of the interest taken off already so that when it presents the bond after 5 or 10 years, it gets full price, which includes all of the interest locked in. Now, why would you do that? Because there's tax advantages. It means you don't have to pay tax during the term of the bond, which might be 5, 10, 20 years. You pay no tax whatsoever, and you've only got to manage the increase in the capital value of the asset at the very end of the 20 years. We call that a deep discount bond. It's very common. And in things like the Treasury bill market in America, a lot of these big common markets, they're sold at discount. So we need to price. The price of the bond is at par, premium, or discount, and then we're going to adjust the coupon. And all of this has to be set against what we think the market expectation for this will be. We can assess that using a red herring or a Pathfinder prospectus. This is very common in the Eurobond market or in the United States or Canadian issues. For UK domestic issues, we have what we call an impact day offering. That's where the lead manager will decide, fix the price and the coupon in advance, and then we just almost take a risk on how it's going to be on the actual day. But if you have good expert investment bankers, that's what they can do. The role of the lawyer, we need to understand everything. We need to understand how the whole transaction works and through that how the market works so that we can draft the documentation to ensure that all of the parties' rights and obligations are properly respected at every stage. The most common deal would simply be a bought deal. The lead bank will just say, we'll undertake to do everything, we'll take on our books, so why would they do it? Because they get a much higher fee. If it's a big public offering, however, we'll need to think about preliminary prospectus or impact day offerings. Timeline again, we'll have initial approach, initial marketing, decision to proceed, and then you'll be instructed, so you'll start to prepare the documentation. We'll confirm the mandate letter and due diligence, D-Day plus 7, and then we'll have a formal announcement to the markets on the launch date. This then begins what we call the grey market. The market knows these bonds or notes are coming in 2 weeks' time or whenever the specified release date is. So what's going to happen is the market's already going to buy and sell. So even though these things don't exist, we're going to have a pre-market. We call that the grey market. So what will actually happen is everybody's buying and selling these notes or bonds even before they've come onto the market, and that can affect the price. So what we actually do is this. We will allow the lead bank to actually manipulate the market price. It's called stabilisation. It's a legal form of manipulation, adjustment, so that they can ensure there's a safe and stable issue when the bonds eventually come to the market on the closing. It's called stabilization. The lead bank is allowed to stabilize the price, because what will happen is we're buying and selling these bonds in the grey market 1 week, 2 weeks, possibly even longer before they've come on to the system. We will draft all the documentation. We will prepare all the documentation. The formal subscription agreement is signed on the signing date, which is D-Day plus 14, still 7 days away from the closing. That's when everyone becomes legally bound. Everyone is legally obliged to proceed with this when the subscription agreement is signed. This is principally between the lead bank or the managing group and the issuer. And the lead bank's going to undertake to subscribe and ensure that all of these notes of bonds are purchased and then sent on into the market. And then you'll have the final closing, which will be D-Day plus 21, essentially 4 weeks from the beginning of the whole of this process. All of the other documents are exchanged, which are signed and exchanged if they haven't been signed earlier. Usually the trustee, the paying agency agreement, fiscal agency agreement, all of that will be left until this stage. It's the subscription agreement that has to be signed on D-Day plus 14. Everything else will then be exchanged. Now, what will happen in practice is this. It takes time to prepare the full bonds if you're going to have a full physical issue. You need security printed certificates. This takes time. It costs a lot of money. What will happen in practice is this. You will not deliver the definitive notes or bonds on the closing. Usually what you have is a TGB, a temporary global bond. I've marked it on the table down there, a TGB. The TGB will be handed over at the closing, and the issuing bank will make a check on an electronic funds transfer for the whole amount of the issuance price, 100 million, for example. So you're going to exchange 100 million for a TBG, a TGB, a temporary global bond. This temporary global bond is a single bond like this one, which represents the whole of the issue. Legally, it's a completely unusual, unique document. We call it sui generis. It's a complete sui generis document. It's issued in favour of the lead bank, who will then act on behalf of everybody else until the definitive notes are printed. In practice, we also have this regulatory gap, and the regulatory gap that's commonly used is 40 days. So usually we'll have a 40-day gap to print the definitive notes, during which time we're going to have other regulatory compliance. That could include, for example, completing the listing to the local stock market. For a euro bond, you'll either list usually on London or Luxembourg, almost exclusively London or Luxembourg for the listings. But what's also going to happen is this. We need to comply with the American securities law. Specifically, we need to comply with the American, it's called the TEFRA. You'll see it on the bottom right. The Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982, TEFRA. This is to allow the issuer or the lead bank to confirm that none of this has been sold to an American citizen anywhere in the world, which I would include on the moon. Any basically the extraterritorial application of American law means you have to not sell this to any American anywhere. Unless you're going to comply with specific exemptions and exclusions which are permitted under American law, and I've given you separate notes on the system to do with this, you can't sell to an American. So you'll have legends which basically say none of this can be sold to an American citizen unless it's under these certain safeguard provisions that we can use. You then have to declare, confirm that none of the bonds are being sold to an American citizen. Because that takes 40 days, we have a 40-day lockup, a 40-day delay. During that time, in practice, you'll have your definitive notes prepared. So there's always a 40-day lockup from closing. Now, in terms of normal standard market practice just now, very often you won't even see these anyway. They're either going to be what we call immobilized, bottom left, or dematerialized. If they're immobilized, what that means is this. As soon as the bonds are actually printed, which will take 40 days, they are delivered to the two custodians who act in this market. And that's Clearstream and Euroclear. Euroclear is in Brussels, Clearstream is in Luxembourg. And these agencies were set up at the very beginning of the bond market to support the Eurobond system. What we're going to do is this. we're going to immobilize them, which means we deliver them to Euroclear or Clearstream, and then they never move. All of the major banks in the world and investment banks will have an account with Euroclear and Clearstream. So when they buy and sell the bonds in the secondary markets after first issuance, primary issuance, they sell it through the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. There's also a bridge between Brussels and Luxembourg in the form of a fibre optic cable. So there's a bridge between Euroclear and Clearstream, so you can sell across the accounts of the two key custodians as well. What will also happen is you'll have possibly other sub-custodians all around the world, in London, in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, and various other places. The bonds never actually are physically released to the market because they're too dangerous. These are bearer bonds. How do you transfer title to a bearer bond? You deliver it. And so long as the person acquiring bond does so without any prior knowledge of defect in title of the transferor, they get perfect title. That's what negotiability means. So these are very dangerous to have in the open market. So they're immobilized. That was the traditional practices during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now, the most common process is now dematerialization. We don't even issue them in a physical form, we issue them in an electronic form. So we dematerialize them. And again, they're sent directly onto the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. So you buy and sell across Euroclear and Clearstream. And that's how this market works. These are typical transactions, typical structures, and that's a typical timeline so that we can see the difference between the euro bond deals, the bond deals, and the loan and credit market deals. In terms of other key issues, what do we need to consider? We've got the basic parties on here. So we have the issuer, we have the arranging bank, we have the public investors, the private investors, we have a trustee, and then either a fiscal or a paying agent. If we have a trustee, it's only a paying agent. If we don't have a trustee, it's a fiscal agent. And then we'll also have the custodian, who's also shown here as well. The key financials, again, always the same. The principal, what's the amount? What's the term? How long are these going to be on the market for? Because what will happen is after term, you represent the bond and you get full payment of principal. We need the interest. In this case, we call this the coupon. The coupon is the additional payment that we're going to pay above, which is the equivalent of interest on our loan transaction. We're going to have in this case, drawdown usually will be single drawdown. It will be just an open single issue on the closing date, 100 million bonds going into the market. If it's shorter notes, we could have what we call a tap issue or like an option whereby subsequent drawdowns will happen over different times in different places. As well as if we're going to set it up in the form of short notes, for example, like 1-year notes, 2-year notes, 3-year notes, we're going to have a note issuance facility. So that is the other term on the bottom document here. So this is what we call disintermediation. So we have immobilization, dematerialization, disintermediation. Disintermediation arises when the investment bank only comes in at the beginning. So the lead bank, the arranging bank, is going to set up the deal. The deal could either provide for the issuance of a whole block of bonds on one open offer, so 20-year bonds, which will all be issued on the closing. If it's going to be a note program, maybe a 5-year note program, or a 3-year, or a 2-year, or a 1-year, or even less, 60 days, 90 days, 3 months, 6 months, whatever, in that case, because we're rolling over, what we want to do is this. We want to disintermediate. We don't want to bring the arranging bank back in every time. We want to set a program up so that the company itself can decide, I'm going to issue more into the market. So every 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, it can issue the notes back into the market itself. That's when it then becomes either committed or uncommitted, and then underwritten or non-underwritten. What tends to happen is short commercial paper is usually not underwritten, whereas euro notes will be underwritten and committed. So the banks have to purchase them, they have to buy them, they have to make sure they're passed on into the market. If it's a commercial paper program, there's nobody guaranteeing the take-up, therefore it's at the issuer's risk. But in all of these cases, we'll have a note issuance facility, a NIF or a note issuance program, a NIP, so that We don't need to bring the banks back in. The arranging bank doesn't have to come in every time there's a new issue. The company just decides itself, am I going to issue into the markets? And then those will either be committed or uncommitted. We also have demutualization and consolidation. What are those? I've already mentioned this with regards to the London Stock Exchange. A lot of the largest markets in the world were essentially just unincorporated associations, basically private members' clubs. These then demutualized. We had what we called the Big Bangs. We had a Big Bang in New York in 1975, with a Big Bang in London in 1986. And essentially, the major stock markets, they demutualize. They go from being private trade associations, private market associations, to public limited companies, and then they list themselves on their own markets. We call that demutualization. Mutualization was when there were mutual companies, mutual associations, when the members owned them. We demutualize by turning them into public limited companies, and then we list them on the markets themselves. That's called demutualization. The subsequent history of stock markets and exchanges is consolidation, where all the stock markets across the world are just buying each other up. And this has been going on for the last 10, 20 years. All of this is summarized in my two chapters on stock markets and exchanges in our edited book on financial markets and exchanges with Oxford University Press. We're now at the third edition of that. All of the regulatory background to all of this is in our parallel book on financial services law. We're now at the fifth edition of that. So, immobilization, dematerialization, disintermediation, demutualization, and consolidation, bottom left. What I've also just done is to summarize the difference between a loan deal and a bond or note in the next column. So how can we summarize that? How can we, in law, specify what a note or a bond is? How can we summarize that? What's the difference between that and a loan, a drawdown under a loan document? All of these bonds and notes, they are short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable. I'm going to make that should say tax-free. Listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted means underwritten or non-underwritten, promissory notes. In law, that's what all of these notes are. So all of the commercial paper, all of the different types of notes, even the bonds themselves, they are bearer, unsecured, negotiable, tax-free, promissory notes. That's essentially what all of these things are in law, legally. The point about tax-free means free of withholding tax. So the banks don't have to, the issuer doesn't have to deduct when they're paying the coupon. So the banks, the investors receive payments gross. If there is a tax gross, if there is a withholding imposed, there'll be a tax gross up clause, as well as very often the issuer can actually cancel the notes. If it doesn't want to pay the tax gross up, it can usually very often withdraw the notes. It can repay them, prepay them, so that there's no need to pay the tax grossing up. If we're comparing banking markets and capital markets, I have this dealt with in further detail in the chapter and on the slides. This is on the fourth column from the top. We can distinguish loans and bonds again. We can look at the issue and sale formality, the documentation complexity, the transferability, the credit control, and the default recovery. We can compare loans and bonds on this basis. I've then expanded that in further detail on the back page, bottom left, these first two columns. I'm looking at the difference between loans and bonds, how we split the provisions and the different types of clauses we include in the different documentation. And then we can understand the nature of a bond in more detail by summarising all the core elements of the bond on the face of the bond and in the documentations which are attached. All of that's provided on the outline as well. What do we have? Parties. I've listed all the parties in the fourth column on the bottom there. Issuer, investors, arrangers, selling groups, the underwriters, the trustee, the paying agent, the fiscal agent. There may be separate guarantors brought in. We need Euroclear and Clearstream are the two custodians. And then we may have separate sub-custodians and other major financial centres. We have the lawyers who are going to draft all of the documentation, ensure that everything works. We'll have separate accountants and auditors who will assist confirm the detail in the data in the prospectus or the offering circular. And then we may have separate tax experts as well. So all of these parties will be involved. In terms of the core documentation, this is in the middle, second column, we need the prospectus or offering circular is the equivalent of the information memorandum in the loan deal. We need the subscription agreement, that's between the arranging bank and the issuer, undertaking to subscribe and ensure that the issue is going to proceed. We have the underwriting agreements and the selling agreements, whereby the underwriters and the selling group will sell the bonds on into the market unless it's a bought deal. If there's a number of managers, we'll have a separate managers agreement, which will manage their relations inter se, as well as divide up the commission between them and possibly allocate the number of bonds they have to purchase each. We'll have a trustee, if it's a very large issue, we'll have a separate independent trustee appointed to act on behalf of the bondholders. The agent bank is acting on behalf of the issuer. Then the fiscal agency, as we've said, if there's a trustee, we only need an agency agreement. If there's no trustee, we need a fiscal agency agreement to create a trust relationship, a fiduciary relationship. And then we'll have the global bond, the TGB, and the definitive bonds and notes afterwards. In terms of issue procedure, this is very similar to a loan deal. We're going to collect the mandate, fee letters, have everything set up. We'll proceed with the launch. We draft the documentation, bring the lawyers in for that purpose. We'll agree all the financial terms. This becomes a bit more complex than the capital market deal because we have to decide, is the price at par, premium or discount? And then as we adjust par, premium and discount, we're also going to reset the coupon to get the most attractive rate to ensure that we raise as much money at the finest coupon rate available so that the investor can raise as much funds out of this at the lowest possible cost. Stabilisation is where the arranging bank, as we've said before, in the grey market, will manage, adjust the price by pre-selling bonds. Normally, that could be considered to be illegal, distorting the market, but it's allowed to protect and stabilise the price in this grey market before final closing. We have the allotment, whereby the selling group and possibly the underwriters, they will not know how much they're going to receive. So we have specific rules on allotting, because if you don't allot correctly and the institution starts selling them on in the grey market before their final allocation is confirmed, this can cause a lot of difficulty in practice. So there's specific rules in the ICME handbook on allotments and pre-allotments and how we adjust and set the figures in these areas. The listing will need to prepare the separate application, the separate documentation, if we want to take the bonds onto one of the formal markets. For the euro bonds, most commonly, these will be listed in London or Luxembourg. This then allows the creation of an active, formal secondary market in these bonds, which should support the price, which means the borrower's issuer can raise more at a cheaper coupon from the very beginning. It doesn't have to be that you want to buy and sell the bonds on the listed stock market in all cases. Very often, you'll want to apply for the listing because it just opens up the market more widely. Very often, professional investors, such as pension companies, insurance companies, unit trusts, even hedge funds, they may have restrictions on what they can purchase. And they will be able very often to buy anything that's listed. So it's much more easy for the larger investment classes of institutions across the rest of the financial market, across the world, to purchase if it's listed. So even though you don't intend to buy and sell on the secondary market afterwards, you could have it listed anyway because it opens up the market to a bigger investor base, which means you can get a finer coupon and a better initial price. The closing, as we've mentioned already, is when we have final exchange of all the documents, residual signatures, delivery of all of the signed executed papers that we're entering into, as well as that will then start the 40-day lockup. So we'll exchange a temporary global bond for the issuance price. And then the definitive bonds will follow 40 days later. In terms of bond structures, we've talked about the Eurobond market, but we can also have domestic markets. So we've got the UK gilts, stocks and bonds. We've got the US Treasury, agency municipal bond market. There's a Japanese government bond market. There's a German government bond market. And I've listed all the different contracts under each of these in the chapter. You've also got the separate corporate bond market, all of the markets we've looked at previously are sovereign, are our governments, but you've also got the corporate bonds. In particular, we have the UK debenture market, the US corporate bond market, and the Japanese, the samurai market. And then we have other separate foreign bonds and other bond variants. Foreign bonds are when you raise funds on the international markets in your own country, in your own currency. A euro bond is when you raise the funds in any financial centre other than the local currency of that financial centre. So that's the difference between a euro bond and a foreign bond market. You'll also see there's a large number of different types of options. So top right, we've got euro bonds. Then we have what we call floating rate notes. So with the collapse of the Bretton Woods foreign currency managed exchange rate system, beginning 1971 with the closure of the gold window by President Richard Nixon on 15th August 1971, we moved over from fixed bonds to floating rate notes. So that's the beginning of the whole floating rate note market, FRNs. The whole history, subsequent development of this market is then one of shorter duration. We're coming down from long notes and long bonds to short bonds. So we have, in that case, because we have short instruments and then we're rolling them over much quickly, we have a note issuance facility, a NIF. So we're going from FRNs down to NIFs. Now, strictly speaking, we went from the long notes and long bonds to the short bonds and the short notes, and then we went back up again. We call them medium-term notes, mainly because that was the importation of the medium-term note market from the American domestic market back into Europe. And all of this is in the chapter, as well as in the other first two chapters I gave you on the historical development of the markets and on the structure and operation of the markets. So I deal with all of this effectively three different times in three different stages. You then have the euro notes. The euro notes are effectively short notes. These could be 1, 2, 3 year notes or even less than 1 year. Most instruments less than 1 year we call paper, but notes and paper can overlap. The difference is, and I've summarised them again in the slides and on the back page, the euro notes as opposed to the commercial paper will be underwritten. We can issue it within days, commercial paper within hours. Maturities will be fixed with the euro notes. Commercial paper could vary. We'll settle within 7 days for euro notes, usually same day for commercial paper, and then the denominations vary as well. If it's a euro note, smallest denominations are typically around 500,000. If it's a commercial paper, we can go down to 100,000. So that's the basic difference between the short commercial paper and the short euro notes. We've also then got perpetuals, or bonds that last forever. Governments used to issue these. They're not as common now because they can be very expensive. They basically last forever unless there's a cancellation clause, and there always will be some form of default provision, so you can cancel on certain specific terms and conditions. Warrants is where you're entitled to buy more of the same thing for a fixed price at a specified date in the future. So you, if you want to make the note issuance attractive or the bond issuance attractive, you'll attach warrants to the bonds. So the bond holder can buy more at a specified price within a time period afterwards and increase their holdings. Convertibles is when you can exchange one type of note or bond for others and, for example, maybe fix the floating or various other variations. Equity linked is when we link to stock markets and other price movements. Commercial paper is less than 1 year. One of the problems that arises with commercial paper is that this is generally made available, sold by companies. But if you're a company selling commercial paper into the market, what are you effectively doing? You're receiving a deposit, or the equivalent of an economic deposit from a depositor, so therefore you're engaging in banking business, which is illegal, because you haven't got a banking license. So the whole of the commercial paper market in most countries is dependent upon creating an exemption to allow countries to issue commercial paper without it constituting the acceptance of deposits and turning them into banks. So we actually started this in the UK, I think it was 1986. So sterling commercial paper only dates from 86, because otherwise this would have constituted a deposit taking, which would have been illegal. Because it's not the banks doing this, this is the companies doing it. This is how companies raise money. Certificates of deposit, we did all this before when we looked at the money markets and the primary money markets. CDs are when you deposit a certain amount of funds with a bank over a specific period. rather than just have an account entry, the bank can give you a certificate which evidences that deposit, and then you can buy and sell that certificate. That's a CD. And then we also have what we call multi-purpose facilities, MOFs, or multi-option funding facilities, MOFFs, MOFs and MOFS. A MOF will typically include a short-term advance, a medium-term note facility, euro and domestic commercial paper, bankers' acceptances, and a swing line facility all together. This is to give maximum flexibility. If the client comes into your office and is saying, we want to raise 100 million, should we go banking markets or capital markets? You'll basically discuss those distinctions we made before. Fourth column at the top right. You can also raise these other issues, these first two columns, three columns, bottom left. But also, what you want to do is to give them maximum flexibility. If you're going to go non-loan and you're going to use capital markets, you could go bonds or short notes or very short euro notes or even informal commercial paper. In practice, very often you'll recommend a MOF. That's the default provision, the default solution, because that gives the company maximum flexibility. That includes a short-term advance, a loan, as well as an MTN program. So that's both a loan and a capital market provision. On top of that, the company can issue commercial paper and it can issue bankers' acceptances, basically bankers' bills of exchange, and have them accepted by the bank which set the facility up. And it can also draw short facilities called swing lines as it moves between other arrangements. So the typical option would be capital or loan. Capital, if you've got good credit standing, you can borrow more at cheaper rates. But if you don't know which way to go in terms of is it a clear note program or an MTN program or a commercial paper program, you would go for a MOF, because that gives the client maximum flexibility. Special issues that arise from a legal perspective we need to watch are stabilisation, listing, negotiability, and then the clearing systems and governing law. I deal with all of this in the chapter in further detail. We've mentioned all of these points. All I've done is expand all the case law on the nature of negotiability, all the famous cases, Picker versus Goodwin, a lot of other core judgments which explain the market decides whether something's negotiable. And we principally look at the duration and frequency of the offering. And if the market decides it's negotiable, it's negotiable. What we'll see in some of the cases, for example, Prussian bonds were negotiable in Prussia, but not in London. Therefore, they were considered not to be negotiable instruments. Who determines this? Market practice, having regard to the duration and frequency of the notes which are being offered. All I've then done is I've summarised the historical development, top left. The difference between euro notes and commercial paper, we've already mentioned. The bond yields, the different types of yields, how can we measure it so we can price the bonds. There's a large number of different types of rates and coupon figures. So I've summarised here the key references, the coupon rate, the current yield, the yield to maturity, the bond equivalent yield, the BEIA, and the effective annual yield, the EIA. That's just so we can understand this. And then all I've done is provide some other variations here. I've got the advantages, disadvantages in the first two columns and the second set of discussion points. Advantages, transferability, anonymity, flexibility, liquidity, disposability. Disadvantages, cost, complexity, constraint, regulation, taxation, and possible market volatility. And then we're getting into all the different types of variations. There's a large, very large number, over 100 of types of variations altogether. We can have zero coupon bonds, foreign currency bonds, reverse dual currencies, first coupons, partly paid, currency change bonds, annuity bonds. All of this is summarised in the chapter in the footnotes. For FRNs, we can have floors, drop locks, double drop locks, caps, collars, inverses, and then also step down, step ups, margins, floating then zeros, fixed then floatings, variables, zero coupons, rolling dates, bunnies and multipliers, lenders, borrowers, lobos, bolos, a whole series of different types of options. I explain all of this in the chapter. It's a very large market. It's a very complex market. The key point simply is this. You have to decide the nature, price and structure of the instrument before you bring it to the market. In the loan market, we can make multiple adjustments after the agreement's entered into and before each drawdown. We can't do that in the capital markets. So what you effectively have to do is this: all the different options that you could imagine and may want to consider, you build these into all these different structures. That's why we have all the variations, because we have to fix the options before we release it to the market on primary issuance. And because we don't have the same flexibility on a continuing basis that we have in the banking markets, the credit markets, because all of this is locked into the structures, once we bring them to the market on primary issuance, that's why we have all these variations. All of these options we can deal with in a typical loan deal, and the borrowers can adjust as they wish over the term of the loan, 20 years possibly. For capital market deals, this has to be locked in to the instrument before you bring it to the market. That's why we have all these different options. And with all of this, we can understand the nature, structure and operation of the international bond market, specifically the Eurobond market and the domestic sovereign and corporate bond markets.